Hey everybody. Research for the new book, doing it today, and it gave me two questions that I'm battling with before we get started. So, number one, would you rather fly around space in hyperspace like the Millennium Falcon, or would you rather jump from point to point like Battlestar Galactica? Galactica seems faster, but hyperspace seems cooler. Because everybody loves seeing like either the Enterprise or the Falcon like zipping through that weird trippy wormhole thing. But I got to figure out how my guys are going to bounce around the cosmos in the new book. So I need comments. I need you guys to let me know which one you prefer. I'm going to make the ultimate decision. I got final edit. Well, my editor has final edit, but for the purposes of the new project, that's question number one. Question two is a big one. Blasters or bullets? Sci-fi gunfighters, should they be carrying energy weapons? Mind you, my thing takes place about 100-ish years ahead of where we are now, so keep that in mind. But do we stick with solid rounds, or do you like seeing the pew-pew of the laser beams shooting through the sky? My guys are going to be better shots than stormtroopers, I can guarantee you that. But when you compare like Firefly old gunfights to stormtrooper gunfights, that's another thing I'm trying to figure out. Writing them, they kind of go either way. There's a couple different things you can do with either genre. So you got your first homework assignment for writer stuff. You got to leave a comment in the show notes, faster than light travel and space weapons. What's your preference on both camps? And other than your friendly reminder to go get Overmatch and its older and just as cool brother, Blood Red Ivory, right now they're both available. So I'm looking forward. I'm really enjoying the comments you guys are leaving, and I'm not going to bomb you with sales pitch. So that is it. So we can get right to it. Tonight, we are chatting with Brett Allen. Brett Allen is a graduate of Michigan State University and former U.S. Army cavalry officer. He's written two novels, Kilroy Was Here and Sly Fox Hollow. He's a husband, father of two, and when not writing, he enjoys drumming his forehead against the surface of his desk and cursing softly under his breath for reasons only he can explain, and maybe he will tonight. I don't know. In Sly Fox Hollow, his newest book, William Bomber Meridian is a small-town grocery store manager by day and a cryptid hunter by night. Bigfoot's sexier, but Bomber's passion lives in the legendary Michigan Dogman. That is going to be the nexus for a kind of paranoia trip throughout the small town of Sly Fox Hollow, which has been a ton of fun to get into. And Kilroy Was Here, loosely based on Brett's time in the military. Kind of a dark take, dark humorous take on his deployment through Afghanistan. So I can't wait to talk about both of those. And Brett, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So in looking at your bio, you were the lead bootleg movie scout during your deployment.
Yep. We were in a pretty rural outpost in Afghanistan. So about halfway through the deployment, we got a little bazaar set up inside the walls of the FOB. And two of the containers that housed the booths or the stores that the local nationals had set up were selling bootleg DVDs. So my role in our S3 operations office was to go over there every Tuesday when they got a shipment and check out what new movies they got in. And I still got a few copies of movies that hadn't been released yet at the time. Now, when some of them had been leaked out, like the Wolverine Origins movie, I got that, and all the CGI isn't completed in the version that I got.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
Every time, again, it jumps into like the skeletal frame of the CGI, and it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I still have a stack of them like that thick. And same thing, I get done. It was like, yeah, Tuesdays or whatever. Get done with dinner, shoot over to the movie place. And I remember getting the Rob Zombie version of Halloween before it was let out, and it was so dark, shot on a handy cam in a movie theater, like the heads, you know, the first time a head pops up and starts walking out, you're like, is that part of the movie? And it's like, I can't see Michael Myers because it's so dark. Like, I don't even know what's going on. It's creepy, creepy music. But when I saw that, I did, when I was over there with NCIS, I was in Ramadi handing over, the Marines were moving and, the 101st was taken over. So I was just shutting down my office, handing stuff over to CID. And, so everybody was gone. I just had a trailer out in the middle of nowhere. And I remember getting Paranormal Activity. And I was like, oh, this would be cool. That scary movie, just chilling by myself. That movie, it was so creepy. Like I still remember this day. I'm like, I picked the wrong time to watch this movie. Like, it's just like, it's just the middle of nowhere. And I'm like, you know, a creepy, like, invisible demon's not that hard to think about. Like,
right.
It's hilarious. That just, when I read that, I was like, that's funny. There's some funny, funny stories that come out of that. Yeah, when I found your books, I was looking at them. I'm starting to read them, and I'm like, writing comedy. My first impression is, it's hard enough to take a story, to take an idea of a story, and put together the entire architecture. You know, get the beginning to the end, have the dramatic structure, but to level in comedy on top of that seems like you're putting yourself at a higher bar. Like, it takes a little more guts to be like, I'm going to write a humorous novel. How did you fall into that, to doing that?
Well, I mean, I've always kind of been drawn to comedies, both in movies and literature. One of my favorite books is Catch-22. So that kind of served as like the inspiration for Kilroy Was Here. I kind of wanted to write like a Afghanistan Catch-22. But I would say, as far as the writing the comedy piece, I've found all of what I've done has been trial and error. I didn't go to school for writing. I basically have been reading books on writing for the last 10, 15 years and trying to piece it together. But I've found that in trying to write comedies, a lot of times the humor is what drives the plot in a lot of points, because you'll have this great idea for where you want the story to go, but then you're writing this character and all of a sudden you come up with something funny for his background or something, and that can completely put you in a different direction for where you want to take that character, and then that changes the storyline. And so I found that I really have to just kind of let the story steer itself as I'm writing it. When I first started writing Kilroy, I tried to outline the heck out of it. I had mapped out every chapter and every scene, and I got about a third of the way into writing the first draft, and everything deviated. So all of that work was kind of a waste of time. But I learned a lot from that. So when I started writing the next book, Slapbox Hollow, I still did some outlining, but I kept it minimal. And only went through about the first two thirds of the book, because I assumed that a lot of it was just going to become garbage anyway. So then it did. I got done with the first draft, didn't care for the ending that I had. So I ended up rewriting the last third of the book. Writing comedy is, it's difficult, just because I know what I think is funny, but I don't know what everybody else thinks funny. And that's one of the most interesting pieces of this whole thing, is just getting the feedback from readers on which pieces struck them as the most funny. It's never the same with any two people. Everybody zeros in on something different in every read. So it's always interesting. And I'm glad that people are picking up on stuff throughout each book, like all through the book. I'm just hoping that people are finding it funny throughout and not just those one or two instances.
Yeah. And that was another one of my questions was, when you write a funny scene, like I've kind of leaned a little bit into, you know, writing in the horror and thriller and a dark fantasy genre, you got to keep a certain level of intensity. But I find, I don't know if it's just because the older I get, like maybe I've just got more in common with Joker now than I did Batman. But I just like I'm writing, I'm like, wouldn't it be funny if he just did this? And in an Overmatch or in Blood Red Ivory, I kind of played with it a little bit. I didn't want Ty Benhoff to be, you know, serious, you know, Marion Cabretti. I compare it to my main character is much more John McClane than Marion Cabretti. You know, McClane is not tactical Timmy by any means, and you know, Cabretti cleans his gun while he's eating pizza. It's like, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm it should be a little more that way. So I tried to throw in a couple one-liners here and there in Blood Red Ivory, but in Overmatch, I have the scene where I'm kind of bringing introducing this fish out of water concept, and you know, my main character just doesn't, he's just to the point, it's very hard for him to take a whole lot of stuff seriously. And so he's explaining law enforcement one day and to this character, and I do it through, like, I wrote a domestic violence scene during the Super Bowl, which was absolutely ridiculous. And when I started writing, I'm like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever written, you know? and as I get done, like, I'm giggling and I'm like, oh, do I show it to my wife? I'm like, no, if there's innuendo in there, she's going to be like, you're ridiculous. So I'm like, do I show it to my beta readers? I'm like, well, I won't tell them about it and just see what happens. But just because I tried something new, writing something humorous, I'll tell you, man, it stopped me. It gave me pause. Like, I'll write anything. I'll be like, well, if people don't like it, whatever. I can't really help that. It's the action. It's the way the book moves. But when I purposely wrote something I intended to be humorous, I had to stop and think about it. Because like you said, I'm afraid I'm going to be like, I'm cracking up. This makes me laugh. But everybody else, it's like, I don't want to hear the pin drop, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I kind of like bracket my beta readers. So I've got like one end of the spectrum of like my buddy from college who thinks just about everything that I think is funny is funny. And then I've got my mom. And like, if I can please both crowds, I think I've pretty much covered the spectrum. But I mean, some things just don't land with people. Some things are, I tried to make not every joke like super obvious, so that I found a lot of times that doesn't land, and then I just take note of that for next time. But yeah, it's hard to please everybody, and comedy is a hard sell, I feel like, because I write a lot of people write books like your books are not intended to be comedy. That's not what people come to your books for. I'm trying to get people to come to my books because they're humorous. And I think that's a harder sell, just because of that fact that not everything lands the same way with everybody as far as jokes go. I found it's harder. I don't know if it's harder. I've never marketed another book, but it's hard to market a humor book when you don't have a background in stand-up comedy or a background in being a funny guy. So,
yeah. And the marketing is the hardest part. Like they don't bother to tell us that when we're like, all right, sure. I wrote a book. Everybody's going to love it. I got to just pick out which yacht I want right now. Cause right. I already know the name. I'm going to call it Scribbler, and I'm going to be looking awesome rolling around the St. Simon Sound. Nice. Has yet to happen. Yeah. But I mean, it's yeah, as you think about it, I don't know how you go about doing it. I've been playing around and trying to learn the Amazon ad game or trying to learn the Facebook ad game, which if you ask 5 people, you'll get 17 different opinions on whether or not it works. It comes down to when you dig into it, it comes down to what are those keywords that the algorithm can pick out and point to get an impression or to get a click on that particular person who's searching Amazon or searching Google. And for the thrillers, even for sci-fi and fantasy, they're nice and they're established, right? So I don't know if you've in looked at that or if that kind of analysis, I don't know how you've had experience with that.
I haven't tried any of the like the Amazon ads or anything like that, just because I get analysis paralysis. I'll go on, like you said, and I'll start doing some research about it, and I'll find like 15 blog posts that are like, it's a waste of time, don't do it, and you're never going to get your money's worth out of it. And then I'll find a few that do, and then I just never end up pulling the trigger on it because I don't sell enough bucks to have a huge budget to do that with or to justify doing it. So then I always just default back to, I just need to write a better book, I guess. And, yeah. And then word will spread that way.
Yep.
As much as like, Twitter can be an awful, awful place. It's also been extremely helpful in networking with other writers and building an audience that way. I would say, aside from like family and friends, most of my sales come from Twitter marketing, just like going on and pitching the book in different ways. And like meeting like people like yourself through Twitter. I landed a gig writing gear reviews a couple of years ago with Task and Purpose magazine for a while via Twitter. And basically all of the bigger strides I've made in this writing career thing have been because of connections I've made on Twitter. So I, as much as it can be a time suck, it's been also a valuable tool. I just have to really limit myself in doing that. Otherwise I don't get any writing time done.
But. Right. Yeah. It's and social media has been one of those things that I just stomach because, you know, in those books that I have had a publisher for, and now it's part of the agreement that you'll, you know, hold a platform and you'll post and you'll do all this stuff. And it's like, I've kind of always done it with like holding my nose up a little bit. And it's just, I'm finally getting to the point, like I quit Twitter 3 times. Like I'd get on there, I'd get about 1,000 followers and realize that it's nothing but angry people screaming at each other. And just like, I just can't. And it's usually during an election year. It's like once everybody just decides to like fly their flag and start hating their neighbor because they vary by about 3% in the way they think, I was just like, I just can't handle it. So I've quit like 3 times. But yeah, this last time I've been like, all right, I just have to do this. But yeah, it's that sphere. Like, I always didn't even think about it, reaching out for people for the podcast until like this year, as I'm looking through, I find like you, for instance, I see you posting, I check out your book and I'm like, that'd be fun to talk about. Cause I have no idea how to comedy is just something I'd be afraid to take a shot at. And I just reached out to you on Twitter or reached out to somebody on Instagram and not even doing the whole official old guy email stuff, you know, that, yeah, it's been better this time. Cause I think I embrace it a little more and just put a, you know, I keep one of those COVID masks for when I'm on Twitter, but there's good stuff too. Like Musk has done a good job with not throttling people. I mean, that opens the door for garbage, but he also, I mean, it's a more honest platform, you know,
right.
But yeah, so I don't know. Do you have a particular strategy like posting? Like there are tons of those too. Like you ask 7 writers, what's your social media strategy? And everybody has a kind of a get rich quick scheme to become like an influencer. And it's like, none of that shit works.
No, it doesn't.
You put any thought into it or just have fun?
I have fun for the most part. I find that I get like too sucked into it. So I've been trying to limit myself to like 1 or 2 days a week to really like focus on marketing. So like Wednesday, I might go on and post about the book a couple times or find some, I like to do like guerrilla warfare on Twitter and find like some famous person's tweet like that has just come out and like relate it to my book in some way in the comments or like quote tweet it with something about the book. And I've actually had quite a bit of success with that. I say quite a bit, but it's like a couple sales here and there, which is quite a bit for me.
It's all relative.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that can be fun. You just find creative ways to kind of jump in on rich people's posts.
Right. Yeah. Maybe still that 0.02% of Miley Cyrus's followers. I don't know.
Yeah. And I tell you what, a lot of it just comes down to volume sometimes, because I'll go like a week or two posting posts about the book and not getting much response. And then I'll post a post one day that's like no better or worse than any of the other posts that I made. And the right person happens to be looking at the right time, retweets it, and then bam, I've sold 10 books that day. So it's really, For me, it seems to be just a matter of timing. The algorithm let this person see it on this day, and I got lucky, and they retweeted it. So, and then I have other people that I follow that they'll be like, "Oh, I didn't even know you released a new book," and it's like, "Well, that tells me right there that not everybody that follows me is seeing everything I post all the time, because I've been posting about this dang thing for the last 7 months." So.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I've played around sometimes with, like, I'll just think of something stupid, like dumbest thing I could think of, and I'll just go to where the trending hashtags, and all I'll do is put in like 12 trending hashtags and see that my impressions go to like 1.5 billion, and it's like, what? This is the dumbest thing ever. And then the next time I try it, it's like the algorithm sees me and thinks I'm a bot or something, and it like cuts everything off. It's like, yeah. I might be in Twitter jail. I might not be. I have no idea. But it's just, I'm just screwing with Skynet, hoping they don't nuke me when the time comes.
Well, now everybody's saying TikTok's the place to go if you're trying to sell books. And that's a nightmare. I have no interest in. I've got a TikTok set up, and my wife was like, "Oh, you should try it." And then I heard myself on a video recording, and I was like, "Nah, not doing that anymore." So, yeah. I will say this though, I did some research on some TikTok, book talk influencers in like humor genre and related genres. And I emailed a few of them, got a few of them that responded back and sent the book over. And one guy actually like showed the book in the video and talked about it for a few minutes. I don't think he's even read it, but he talked about it for a few minutes, and my sales spiked that weekend, and like visits to my blog spiked. So I'm like, hey, maybe there is something to this, but it's more of how do I get it in the hands of somebody who's already got a platform instead of spending years wasting my time building a platform when I should be writing.
So. Yeah, exactly. And I've played around with BookTok before, and it's like, I just feel like an idiot. I respect those BookTok people that do the book photography and do the videos and stuff. But I have the same problem. Like just being at least talking, like I barely even want to like listen to my podcast just cause I can't stand hearing my voice. I walked out of I was doing some work when I was on a call, and I walk out, and my whole family's sitting around in the living room watching YouTube, and I walk in, I'm like, that sounds familiar. And I look up, and they're watching one of my interviews, and I'm like, oh, you gotta stop. Please stop. And it was one of the ones that was video. It might've been Piccolo, the Protectors or something like that. And I'm just like, oh. Just then they're like, oh, we're not turning this off. This is gold. I'm like, that's not gold. They're like, it is for us. And so I'm watching it, and I start going to like game film. I'm like, all right, I'm watching game film, like get something out of this. And I'm like 5 minutes out, like, I just can't. I just left. I was like, I can't do this. So the idea of me posting videos of myself to sell my books, I'm like, I get it. And I'm really happy for the people that works for it, but I just feel like an idiot. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Every time I try to explain my book to anybody, I feel like I'm a serial killer trying to explain my motives or something like that. And it's bad.
Yeah, that or a like multi-level marketing person. I'm like, that's just, you know, buy my book. I'm like, oh, I can't do that. Like, I feel like I'm trying to sell them a timeshare. but yeah, writing's way more fun. So we should talk about that. The Kilroy, the Kilroy book, just it starts out, and like I said, I've been bouncing back and forth between both of them, but yeah, so I love it when it kind of, like you said, the catch 22 thing, just finding all those little moments that are just hilarious to you and yours, and like on the outside people would be like, that kind of stuff would never actually happen in the real world. It's like, oh, you have no idea how ridiculous life gets, right? So yeah. Feedback from the guys you deployed with, and then feedback from civilians who they're just like, you're making this up. How'd that go with the first offering?
Well, it's funny you say that, because that's actually what prompted me to write this book. Like while we were deployed, I said to one of my friends in the S3 shop, I was like, nobody would believe this if I put this in a book. And then I was like, I'm putting it in a book. And so like 2 years after I got home, I started working on Kilroy. But it's been really cool getting feedback from the guys that were there. I get a lot of comments from people that are like, I can't believe you remembered that, or I didn't remember that until you wrote, I read the book and jogged my memory on this. Because a lot of the stuff in the book, despite how ridiculous a lot of the stuff is, it's most of it is based on real things that happened while we were there. And I don't think people really realize to what extent that it's real. But you know, I definitely did exaggerate a lot of things just for the sake of comedy. But it's interesting with the civilian side. It's hit and miss. Like, I get a lot of people who are fans of like MASH and who have read Catch 22 and Hogan's Heroes. I've got like comparisons to that and really enjoy comedy no matter what genre it's in. And then there are the other half of the coin is that there's a lot of people who just like it doesn't resonate with them because it's military, it's a world they don't relate to, and they just couldn't get into it. I had a couple comments from people that I tried to read it but I couldn't get into it, I just didn't understand like the lingo and stuff, which I get, it's not for everybody.
Yeah, but, and that's with everything. I remember my first impression as I you know, start adjusting. I'm like, well, I come out and I'm going to work and I'm like, everybody's wearing camouflage, but they also have reflective belts on. I'm like, how did this happen? Like, whose idea was this? Like, yep. I'm just like, I don't understand. I don't understand how this happens, but somebody with like stars said, you know what we need? Safety. we can't, all these people we've trained to work in a hostile environment, you know what they don't need? They don't need to carry magazines in their guns with one in the chamber. We can't have any of that. And by the way, we need to see them at night, you know, despite the fact they're surrounded and taking rockets whenever somebody feels like launching one out of a pickup. It's like
the whole, like one person messes up and everybody gets punished kind of thing. So,
yeah, but on a grand scale. Oh man. So it's that's some good stuff. So what you write that, and that's got a biographical nature to it. Was there always a plan to keep doing it? Was the first one an experiment or how did that come up? Was it one of those, like for me, I got done with grad school and I was like, I'm going to try to write a book. And I got done with the book. I was like, that was fun. I'm going to do another one and just figure something out.
Yeah. Well, when I got out of the Army, I had intentions of applying to film schools. I really liked the idea of script writing and possibly getting into like the actual like production of the movies. I even studied for the GRE, took the GRE, and then life hit me upside the head. I started dating my now wife and I moved back to Michigan and just kind of, I mean, plans changed and I decided I would satisfy my creative desires by writing this book. And so I started, like I said, I was doing research on the whole process while simultaneously just kind of blindly fumbling in the dark. Started writing the first draft from like three different people's perspectives. And I was like, I'll just intertwine the stories. And then I got about 10 chapters in. And I was like, this is really hard. I don't like it. So instead of giving up on it, I mashed all those characters into one character and wrote the rest of the first draft from the first person perspective, then went back and rewrote the first 10 chapters completely new. So I did all of my writing career has been just a series of mistakes that I've had to redo a lot of work and learn along the way. I don't know. It's been an interesting process, and I wanted to, once I got done with Kilroy, I was really proud of it. And I was like, working a job doing logistics for a food service company. And I was just like, I do not want to keep doing this. Writing's what I want to do. So I need to do everything in my physical power to like go in that direction. As luck would have it, a couple months down the road, a buddy of mine who owns his own law firm His paralegals just stopped showing up to work, and he was complaining about it one day at work. And I was like, well, how much are you paying her? And he told me it was comparable to what I was getting. And I was like, listen, I'll come do this for you, with the, if you'll have me, with the added bonus that whatever time I'm not actively employed in the law firm, I get to work on my writing. And he was like, definitely. So nice. I have got a pretty good setup now. I really can't complain. My day job is I'm a paralegal / office manager at a law firm here. And whenever we're in our slow seasons, I get a lot of extra time for writing and whatnot. So, and my kids are getting a little bit older and they're not thinking dad's as cool anymore. So like they, whenever they want to ditch me, I get more time for writing there too. But
yeah. And when you can do it at work, you've got that space away from everybody. So you got a little bubble, right?
Yeah.
I ended up just setting rules for myself while I went into work, an hour and a half early before anybody got there and before the day started. I just had that space. I wrote my second book sitting in the front of my truck because my office had changed and I didn't have space. So I was like, yeah, I'll just slide my driver's seat back and sit there in the dark, banging away on a keyboard every day before work. But yeah, it's man, when you can find that sweet spot, that's it right there. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now you said you had plans to go to film school at one point. So have you always had that artistic side, or was it something that grew or?
It's varied. I've always had a creative side. When I was younger, like in middle school and high school, it was more like the visual art stuff. I was really into drawing, and I used to like draw comic strips and things like that. But I let grownups get in my way.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. I kept hearing a lot that you can't make a good living doing that kind of stuff, and you should go to school for something that's going to provide a good living and be financially stable. And well, all that's great advice. They don't tell you that, oh yeah, by the way, you're going to be miserable from 9 to 5 for the next 40 years.
Exactly.
So I ended up going to school for supply chain management was like my seventh major that I chose. And I ended up there because it was the last major at Michigan State I could do and still get out in 4 years. When I got out of the Army, I mean, I had a lot of experience in the Army of doing logistics, even in a cavalry role, but I couldn't stomach the thought of doing that for the rest of my life. And I knew that if I didn't get into something where I had a creative outlet, I was going to go insane. So.
Yeah, but I remember exactly, when you're a kid, you're like, I'm going to be a baseball player. It's like 0.02% of people actually become a professional baseball player. It's like, well, it's just fun. I enjoy it. And then,
right.
You know, when you're like, I think I'm going to be a writer because, you know, Michael Crichton just lives this really cool life and Tom Clancy's on an aircraft carrier. Like, this is how you do it. And they're like, well, that's very hard to do. And I don't know if it was just that generation or what, but they're just like that, you know, nobody ever makes it. Go work at the factory with everybody else. Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's safe. It's safer that way.
But
you guys are angry all the time. Why?
Right. Now we know why.
Yeah.
Yeah, with our kids, we've been very focused on like, yeah, you want to like get something that's like a stable career and stuff, but also something that you're going to like to do. So, I mean, my kids are 10 and 8, so like they're kind of a long way off from making those decisions, but they're also starting to zero in on some of those things that they like to do. Like my son likes to draw and write, and my daughter loves science, and she's always like this Saturday Sunday morning, her Sunday morning TV show that she decided to pick was a science show, and she went and grabbed a clipboard and a piece of paper and was taking notes. And I was like, what is going on here? But yeah, so I mean, you see them gravitate towards something like that and push it. I mean, even if they're not like a Michael Crichton or Tom Clancy, they can do something in that genre that will satisfy them and maybe become that someday. So,
yeah, I had a buddy of mine put it the right way. He said that find a job that you like, but will also pay you enough to go do what you really want to do. Right.
Right.
If you can't, you know, become Tom Clancy or, you know, Chipper Jones, then find a cool gig that you enjoy and then do the cool stuff that you really want to do on your off time. I was like,
yep,
that's really smart. I wish I had thought of that. Well, I did. I do. I love my job. I've always loved my job. But yeah, it's one of those things. It's like, yeah, that's a good thing to tell kids. Like, well, why don't we start with that? You know,
right.
We start with why not, and then let life, you know, let them figure it out as they get older. So
it's crazy that we make them like decide what they're going to do for the rest of their life when they're 18 with no life experience. Right. So,
yeah, it's like, go pick a major and plan on doing that forever.
Yeah.
Like, no.
$100,000 for that major
exactly. And be in
debt while you're doing it.
Yeah. And how many people do you know that they go to school for whatever they do and they have their career has nothing to do with what they got a degree in? It's just, it's like,
that's me.
See, yeah. Yeah, I was only going to be qualified as a bartender or law enforcement with a criminal justice degree. There was no other option. So it was like, oh, pick one that's easier on the liver. But man, it's so the Sly Fox Hollow, when you transitioned into it's like a kind of like a political book, right? Like just a paranoia in a small town with, of all things, it's hard to bring stuff up because you don't want to spoil anything. But the fact that you had a mom joke in like the first 10 pages, I was like, well, I'm in. Yeah. And you're ripping on the FBI within the first two. I was like, yeah, this is going to be fun. but Bomber and his boys. And then just, I was just like, man, this has got an air of ridiculousness to it. That's just so much fun to get lost in. It was just, and not ridiculous in a bad way, but it's like, these characters are all a little bit nuts and it's like, this is going to be a fun ride. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So this all started with like our current election climates. Like you said that this year was going to suck on Twitter, but this year is like my prime marketing time for this book, because I started writing this book because I was like, somebody's got to just lampoon this ridiculous culture we've cultivated around elections.
Yeah.
And I wanted to set it in a small town, and I'm from a small town. So the structural base of the story, or the town in the story, is based off from the town I grew up in. And a lot of people that are from there have told me they recognize certain places and hopefully not people, because I didn't base the people on people I knew growing up. But yeah, I lost my train of thought there.
Just the small town vibe and
yeah. So I thought I could encapsulate this ridiculous culture of the elections into just this small, relatable town, that it could really strike some people as funny, and then give them some really ridiculous characters, kind of in the same vein of, like, I don't know if you've read A Confederacy of Dunces or anything Kurt Vonnegut. I mean, he has got ridiculous characters in a lot of his stories. But I also wanted to make it kind of Wes Anderson-ish in its some of its dry humor too, but it was a lot of fun to write. And when I got into it, I didn't expect to incorporate the Michigan Dog Man and make it like more of a speculative fiction kind of thing, but as I was going, I was like, I really need like some major big bad for these ridiculous political candidates to get people rallied against, or like drum up fear against, because this was all happening around the same time as COVID. And I was like, the way each side is using this to just drum up fear, I need something big like that. So I was like, what kind of like local monster legends do we have around here? And I started Googling, and I found that the Michigan Dogman is actually pretty pretty prevalent legend up in northern Michigan. So I kind of grasped onto that. I actually found a few books that were devoted to recounting dogman sightings and stuff like that. I read those. And the story just kind of evolved from there. But yeah, it does get ridiculous. And but that's the intention. I hope people like embrace that instead of get repelled by it. So
now when I was reading, it was just so much. It was just light. But I mean, you've got a pretty savage thing that happens up front, but it's light. And the characters are just, all of them are likable, like the townspeople in Blazing Saddles, you know. There's just that's just great country gibberish, you know, right. It's in some places. And that was, I also had that question, like when Dogman shows up, it's like, I wondered if you don't by any chance just go running off every now and then, sitting in a cornfield and in a ghillie suit, just wondering if Dogman's gonna happen by today, you know. if you were like a fan, or if it was just like, I need something ridiculous to throw in the middle of this book and this guy fits.
Well, I mean, I grew up, my grandpa was actually an apple farmer in Fremont, Michigan. So I grew up planting a lot of apple orchards, and I just remember like the feeling of walking through the apple orchard, and you're going row after row after row, and like you're constantly looking down these rows, and just I at least in my mind, because I'm kind of weird, like I was always just like anticipating something being in that next row, something weird, some animal, some, and you know, it never really happens. You might get a deer every now and then, but I always just in like remember anticipating like something crazy being down the next row. So I wanted to give the reader something crazy to latch onto. And then, I thought with the dog man, I'll instantly have some buy-in from people that know the legend. And then I'll take that dog man legend and kind of spin it and make it my own and give it its own background.
So. Yeah. And, I wouldn't want to insult your age, but like I don't know how old you are, but the movies we grew up with, and you know, like Children of the Corn, those small town monster movies, just that, and you know, okay, you're from Michigan, that you grew up in Michigan. Yep. There's nothing spookier than the woods on, you know, in the wintertime when everything turns blue and you just in that right at dusk, there's nothing spookier than woods in the wintertime. From everything looking like a skeleton because there's no leaves, to the branches banging around on each other off in the distance. That's such a fun thing to play with. Cause as a kid growing up playing around in the woods the whole time or racing through cornfields, you know, it's like, what's in that next row? Cause you can't see anything.
I'm sitting in my tree stand before the sun comes up, and it's like you said, it's snowy out there and all you're hearing are branches clicking together. And then all of a sudden you hear something off in the distance and you know it's not a deer. It's like, what was that? there's still that little primal twinge there.
I remember the first time I was pig hunting in a stand, and you know, getting towards dark, getting into dark, and sitting there, all the noises start. But then, you know, deer hunting's one thing, but the pigs talk too much. Like when you start hearing some of the sounds those damn things make, it's like, I don't know what that is, but I really hope it's a pig. Cause anything else is I'm going to die. I'm just up here in this tree stand. I'm dead. Pig hunting is down south, again, but, I remember you'll appreciate this. So we're pushing hard. I got some friends down, and we're really pushing hard. We've been hunting like crazy. And, so we get up in this tree stand. It's like the third or fourth day. We've been pushing really hard. So I get up in my tree stand, I'm hanging out. It's dark. And, since we've had friends down, we've been partying just as much as we've been out in the woods. I'm just tired. And I'm like, I'll shoot something next week. So I was like, I get up there and I sit in my tree stand, and I take my rifle sling and I wrap it through the frame, and I just curl up with my little 30-30, and I'm laying there and I'm just like listening to stuff, and I'm just about out, and all of a sudden the sounds are directly above me, and I'm like, Well, that's just wind. I'm like, it's cool. So I'm like, just wind. And so I curl back up. I'm just snuggling with my gun. And all of a sudden, boom, it hits again. I'm like, the whole tree shakes. I'm like, oh, it's a freaking bear or something. I'm like, shit. So I'm like looking. I can't see anything. And I'm like, okay, it's quiet. I'm tired. I snuggle back up with my gun. And then, bam, everything explodes. And I look up and I look and there's a barred owl, you know, those really huge striped barred owls. Dude is sitting on my tree stand with me. Like he's just sitting there and he's like 2.5, 3 feet tall. So he had been up in the trees, smashed everything down and just landed there. And I'm sitting there. I'm sitting there. He's like arm's length away and he's looking at me and he's like, what the hell is this thing doing in my tree? And he turns around and he looks off over the field that I'm watching over. And he's like, I don't know why you're here. And he just turns back around. He just stares at me for like 2 minutes. I'm just like,
that's awesome.
This is nuts. But it's like, that's the kind of stuff that freaks you out. Like it's a bird. It's a bird, but it's sounding like a monster.
Yeah. I was talking about pig hunting down south. I was, we were doing a land nav course on Fort Benning and we were doing the night land nav piece. And I'm walking through the woods, just the red lens, elbow flashlight out, trying to find my point. And all of a sudden I hear some brush rustling off in the distance. I'm like, oh, sweet. Another cadet out here trying to find his point. And we can see if we can find it together. And then all of a sudden I start hearing snorting. And I was like, ah, crap, that's pigs. So I like start backpedaling and they're like coming in my direction. And it's like pitch black out and I can't see hardly anything besides what the red lens shows. So I click that out, get my knife out and I'm still backpedaling. And finally I reach this ravine and they're still coming toward me. So I get down in the ravine and like bolt off to the different direction, kind of like perpendicular to where they were coming from. And then they hit the ravine and kind of branched off and went the other direction. But that scared the crap out of me. Like, yeah. I was 19 years old. So I don't know what pigs can do to a person of that age, but I know it's not good.
So. Yeah. And in Michigan and New York, that's where I'm, upstate New York, they don't make sounds like that. Deer don't sound like that. Like, yeah. It's just it's not natural.
Yeah.
But man, yeah, but finding that fear mode to pit of all the things, find the dog man to pit politicians against in a small town. It's just captures that fear, like the same thing that triggered people to steal all the toilet paper out of a grocery store.
Right,
like, just hit it perfectly. <You know? laughs> And just you know, putting that mirror up to our own society is just fun. You know, it's just putting that reflection up to show us all how ridiculous we are is such a necessary thing. And I don't know if we see that as much anymore. Like you mentioned Vonnegut and you mentioned, you know, Catch-22, you mentioned all these things that they would be like, this is how dumb we are. I want you guys to see this because this is all of us, right? They don't do that.
Yeah. I that's kind of what I was going for. And yeah. I tried to be like, equal opportunity on both sides, because I like to think that there are a vast majority of quiet Americans who can see both sides and how ridiculous everything is. And that's really where I wanted to sell the books. So I tried to pick on both sides as equally as I could, just to keep that even, because I don't think any side is righter than the other side. I think there's just a lot of ridiculous people or a minority of ridiculous people making the majority of the noise. I think because of social media and because of regular media, that's all we see. And so we assume that that's everyone. And I hope that the book helps people realize that there are some regular people out there who just want to have things go back to people being nice to each other. But
yeah, just sanity. Have Republicans and Democrats have a beer together. Just chill, right. Just settle down and let's give the libertarians a try. Cause they really just want to be able to smoke weed. You know, I mean, and they'll let the rest of us do what we want. We'll give them half a Congress, maybe a cabinet position, give them their weed and they'll leave us alone. Just let us do our thing.
Right.
Oh man, but yeah, it's you know, that just highlights that that COVID generation, like, you know, trying to be an adult or a parent, much less trying to be a kid in that environment. They were so stunted. But for anybody that was through that, like, how do you take anything you hear from government or media seriously? Like, and like you said, it doesn't matter what side you're on. There shouldn't be a side. They're all the same lunatics, just right. trying to pit everybody against each other. It's like,
yeah,
if those who were able to maintain their idealism, their ideologue, you know, fixture throughout all that, it's like, you guys, your blinders are stronger than most. It's like, this whole thing's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope that people are kind of waking up to that. But it, you know, just when you start thinking that that might be the case, then we reach a new election cycle and it all like goes back. It's just, everything's amplified tenfold and you can't escape it. Like, the only way to escape it is to like shut yourself off from media in general, and then you're uninformed. So how do you win?
Yeah. Yeah. The balance. I try to, when somebody pulls a party line, I try to be like, hey, can you look at like three different headlines before you make your decision? Just, yeah, just right. Go to Fox News, go to CNN, and then hit up CBS, just see what happens, and just right. try to just get an idea. That's but politics.
Or maybe like you cited that headline, but maybe you should try reading the article underneath it to find out what it's actually about.
Yep. Especially the last paragraph where they pretty much do the caveat with that everything we said above is probably not true.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. But man, that's just fun. What are you doing next? What's on the docket? Are you got something else coming down the pipe?
Yeah. So I've got two things right now. I have a rough draft for a Western, that I'm working nice. In a second draft. It's a Western comedy. So, but I wrote the first draft, just kind of, every day I was doing 500 words and whatever struck me, that's just the direction I went. Now I'm actually doing a lot of research and zeroing in more on the second draft. And I'm actually finding a lot of awesome material to go off from. And then the second project, I'm pretty sure I can talk about it now because they announced it the other day, but I don't know if you have come across Mark Sibley on Twitter, but he's the author of Mongol Moon, which is a kind of like a, I guess you'd say an apocalyptic thriller. It came out a couple months before Kilroy was here. And he has, if you want to talk to somebody about who's done a great job with like Twitter marketing, it's that guy. He's built up quite the following and his book is great. He just came out with the sequel after his followers had been harassing him for the last couple of years on when it was going to come out.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah. So his sequel just came out, Dance of Devils. And they just announced his publisher just announced they're doing an anthology of short stories set within his Mongol Moon world. So, nice. And he invited me to do a short story for that. So that's one thing I'm going to place that in front of the novel I'm currently working on to see if I can get that done. But I'm trying to reread Mongol Moon and then read the sequel before I start working on that.
So. What a great opportunity.
Yeah.
To write in somebody else's world's got to be just cool.
Yeah. And they kind of made it sound like I can stick with my style. I don't have to like try to mimic any style or anything like that. So it should be kind of fun to play around with. I feel like I can, basically he's like anywhere in the world, any situation you want to write about, given what has happened in these two books, go for it. As long as it doesn't like interfere with his storyline for like sequel books. So
that's should be awesome. A lot of fun. Yeah, it's fun when somebody can say they're experimenting with something, you know, because as, you know, writers, independent writers, whatever, you know, people try to focus on the business because we don't understand it, you know, so we want to write a certain way or we think you're supposed to sell books. That's fine. I'm still figuring all that out. But when you can say, you know, I've got this this invitation, and they're like, play around with it. It's like, man, we don't get to do that much anymore because everybody's so focused on trying to build a career. You know, the art kind of disappears every now and then.
Yeah. And that's one thing I was doing the last year. I've kind of stopped because I was getting too many first drafts of things. But I was forcing myself to do 500 words of new fiction every day. And I did that for a full year. And I got a lot of great stuff out of it. But like, there were some days when I would sit down and I had just finished like a short story, first draft of a short story, and I didn't know what I was gonna. And some of my best stuff has come out of that, where I just sat down with a blank slate and just like started typing, and on one idea snowballed into another, and like you just get to play around with it, and you go into it with the mental concept of 90% of this stuff is going to get trashed, but at least I'm having fun and it's something like pure that I'm doing, and I'm not trying to like fit what I'm doing into some mold, predetermined mold that I've made for myself. So it's a good exercise if anybody out there is looking to spark some ideas. So
yeah, it's cool. Just riffing, I guess. Yep. Just getting in that zone. Yeah. Getting in the zone and surfing the mind. that's fun. Yep. Well, Brett, we've been going about an hour, and I try not to keep too many people. It's a weeknight. You got the kids at home. Same deal. So I try not to keep people too much more than an hour. But before you go, every veteran, every servant that comes on, I ask the same question. 18-year-old kid standing outside the recruiter's office, trying to decide whether or not they want to walk through the door. What advice would you give them?
Do it. If you read Kilroy Was Here, you'd think I'd had a negative experience, maybe, but I didn't. I would do it again in a heartbeat. The amount of personal growth I got out of my time in the military is irreplaceable. If I didn't cultivate the discipline I did in the military, I probably wouldn't be writing books right now, because I would probably just be sitting upstairs watching TV and drinking beers. And you learn how to fill your time with productive stuff. And I feel like that's the most valuable thing that I took away from the military, besides the friendships that I'm in. And I've been able to apply that to every aspect of my life. And I think everybody would benefit from that.
Yeah, I'll tell you one of the, and I've said it before, people are probably sick of hearing me say it, but I'll say it all day long, that one of the most lasting impressions that I've gotten in my career was seeing the professionalism of like 18 to 25 year old, you know, soldiers, sailors, and Marines, airmen too. I wasn't going to leave you guys out. Just seeing them in a contingency, you know, environment, and just thinking at 18 years old, I could barely get out the door without smacking my face. I was an idiot. And seeing these, you know, out of high school kids, men and women, but just the professionalism, like you said, just that level of dedication and maturity was something that I was just impressed from the moment I got into that world. I was a civilian, but to see that world and to see that level of professionalism from those Americans, it still sticks with me to this day. It was amazing. But yeah thanks.
It was one of the best experiences of my life. So I still talk to tons of the people that I served with. They've been a great network, especially with writing these books. And I still get up every day at 5 o'clock, work out, and then get after it. So I feel like you can't lose by developing those kind of routines at an early age.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you joining me. Before we go, Twitter, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, at Hogwash Writing and at hogwashwriting.com or hogwashwriting.com.
Yep.
That's all the places we find you outside of Kindle.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so right. Books are on Amazon. They can get them at Barnes & Noble, anywhere. Any bookstore can bring them in if you ask them. So they can't escape it.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, I thank you so much for joining me. And when the Western comes out, I can't wait to talk about that one too. So you got to come back.
Sounds good. I would love to. I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome, man. Thanks. Good night, everybody.